There is a story that I would describe almost as old as time that goes like this. It follows a group of people who eventually grow in size to become a great nation, but they are an oppressed people, a marginalized people by a foreign nation and an evil ruler of the foreign nation. And time goes on to where this just becomes the accepted reality of life for this group of people. But eventually, a son of the people rises up to a place of prominence. And the reason why he rises up is in part because he begins to see the evil reality that he had accepted as normal before. So he rises up and goes through a time period of training and preparation, and then the battle begins, where he takes on this evil empire and their ruler. And it seems like as the battle goes on, like there's many times where it seems defeat is the inevitable reality that will come about. But as they stick with it, the people continue to rise up and they achieve victory and vindication and overcome the evil to experience a new day of freedom and liberation. And what I have just described in summary sort of terms is the book of Exodus. But it's also many other stories that you know well. For instance, what I have just described, really inspired by the Exodus story, is The Lord of the Rings, as Frodo takes the ring to Mount Doom and overcomes the evil ruler Sauron. I have also described Star Wars as Luke Skywalker becomes a Jedi warrior and joins with the Rebel Alliance as they take on the evil empire. And I have also described Harry Potter, who embraces his identity as a wizard and then rises up to fight against Lord Voldemort. And I have also, believe it or not, just described, in summary, a children's story which became a movie named Shrek. I have described that as Shrek, who is wandering through the swamp, eventually, even though he's unhappy, becomes friends with a group of creatures who had been banished by an evil lord away from their home. The Exodus story is the foundation for many of the stories that we embrace and love today that have been written in the last 50 to 100 years. And I think at least in part, this is because the Exodus story identifies the deepest longings and desires of our souls. We long for freedom and liberation in our own world, that we face evil realities of sin and the destructiveness of the world that we see all around us. We long for liberation from these things. Even Jesus himself saw himself as a part of the Exodus story. He gathered the disciples in what's known as the Last Supper. He gathered them together, and it was the Passover meal that they were taking part of, and he took elements of the Passover meal, and he said that he himself was a fulfillment of this Passover meal. And so this feeling of exile, of longing for a hero to liberate us from the evil realities that we face, it's the cry of our heart. It's more than just a good story. It is God's desire to be at work in us today. And it was so inspiring for J.R.R. Tolkien that he really allowed it to motivate his writing for The Lord of the Rings. In one of the letters that he wrote before he wrote The Lord of the Rings, he described this kind of desire that the human heart has in very Exodus-like terms. He says, "We all long for Eden, and we are constantly glimpsing it, our whole nature at its best and least corrupted, its gentlest and most humane, is still soaked with the sense of exile." In other words, even when everything is great, even when the push of sin and the corruption of the world seem less pressing, like we're in a more ideal situation, even then, we have a longing for something more, something that we just can't quite get to. Our hearts long for a deliverance from the bondage that is the reality of our lives. And so we titled this series that we're going through in Exodus, we titled it Hope in the wilderness. And wilderness is really a double meaning in the book of Exodus. First, it's the nation of Israel in slavery, which functions like a wilderness for them, in longing for liberation and deliverance. And then later in the book, as God provides, they wander through a literal wilderness. And so it functions in that way. So we're going to enter into this story for 12 weeks. And I know some of you might be wondering or just have that thought in your mind. Why would you spend 12 weeks studying one book of the Bible, even if it is 40 chapters long? Why one book? Well, I think the answer that I would give is that the main character of the book, more than we meet Moses and Pharaoh, the main character underneath all of the stories that make up the book of Exodus is God. It's God. He's the one actively involved all throughout the story. And so what we come to see through Exodus is the ability to see God rightly and understand who he is and how he acts. And when we see and understand God rightly, it begins to shape our hearts in the way that he longs for us to be because he made us. It's when we have a weak view or a low view or a weak understanding of who God is, that is when we begin to have difficulty in understanding God, and we then struggle to relate with those around us because we live out of alignment with the Creator who has made us and who knows us better than we know ourselves. And so that's why we're going to spend 12 weeks in Exodus. With all that said, let me explain a little bit about the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus is the second book of the Bible. It's also known as the second book of the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch is just a big fancy word that means five books. It's part of the first five books of the Bible that tell one singular story that begins with God creating and making everything, and it ends with God developing a family and then a nation and delivering them into the promised land. And so it tells that story all the way through these five books. And so today what we're going to do is jump into the middle of the story. And part of my goal for today is that we would begin to understand the parts of Genesis that come before it, that come to bear and into play in the first part of Exodus, so that we kind of understand where we are in the story that God is telling here in these first five books. So to do that, we're going to look at Exodus 1, verses 1 through 8 to get us started. And I know 8 verses, when you have 40 chapters to cover, is not very much, right? But it'll help set the stage for where we're going to go throughout these 12 weeks. Exodus 1, verse 1, begins like this. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers in all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. And this is the word of the Lord. And verse 8 literally has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about today. I thought I would just read it to kind of whet your appetite, because next Sunday we'll spend quite a bit of time talking about this new king who came to power in Egypt. But really, our focus is going to be on those first 7 verses. And I know many of you, as I'm reading through those, were probably like, okay, but what's next? Like, there's not really anything there. And so what we're going to do is talk about those 7 verses, because there is actually, believe it or not, a lot there. A whole lot of Genesis comes out in those first 7 verses. And so we're going to work our way back to be able to understand where we are in these first 7 verses. And I'd like to break it down into just a few different parts about how we understand a God who is at work here in Exodus 1. And the first part that we see is that God has a plan. God has a plan. It says in verse 5, which is kind of a summary of those first five verses, the descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Christianity is not a deistic faith. And I know that's probably a confusing statement for a lot of you. What I mean by that, deism is this understanding of God that was especially popular in like the 16 and 1700s that saw God as a creator who did not intervene in the affairs of human beings. Did not intervene. And so deism is like a God who loves to make cars and build engines and who starts the ignition and then gets out of the car and tells us to get in the car and he watches us drive wherever we decide to go. But the Christian faith is in contrast to that. According to the teaching of the Bible, God is always involved in the affairs of human lives. He is always in our business. He's always intervening. He is always actively at work. The highs and lows that come to us in life are brought to us by the sovereign God who is in control and involved. So we believe that God is in our business all the time. And so you can see how there's this contrast between deism, which says that God isn't involved at all, and what the Bible teaches, often known as theism or Christian theism, which says that God made it and he's actively involved in our lives. So there's this major contrast. And what we see is that when we embrace Christian theism and the teachings of the Bible, we begin to see that God's sovereign hand is bringing to us whatever it is. And that we can have now with confidence the good and the bad that God's promises will come to pass because God is involved. But if we're really honest with each other, if we're willing to be honest with each other, at times, you and I are kind of drawn to more of the deistic understanding of God, who's not involved. Because when we look at our lives and the situation of our world, it's difficult at times to understand how God could be good and involved. And we look at our own lives, the difficulties we face, and we think, there is no way that God could have brought this to my life. Because there is nothing good that could come from this. And so we struggle and we doubt and we get frustrated with God. And I wonder if you would say you've had this experience in life where it has become hard to trust that God is at work. Or it has been hard to believe that God could have something good in mind. That you felt abandoned by God. Or it's been difficult to walk with the Lord through something that has come into your life. And what I want you to do is if that's true of you, if you've had those struggles, just raise your hand. Just raise your hand. Now keep your hand up because here's what I'd like you to do. Look around the room. You're in good company, right? A lot of us, if not all of us, would say there are times when it sure seems like this God could not be good or could not be involved because the two of them coming together do not make sense. And it's this idea that God has a plan that's highlighted there in verse 5 and talks about the sons of Jacob, which really brings us back to the book of Genesis and the story of Joseph, which is in Genesis 37 through 50. But to really understand everything that's bound up in those first five verses, we have to go back to the very beginning of the book of Genesis, when God created everything. And it says he created everything and that he said it was good. And he created Adam and Eve, and he gave Adam and Eve instructions about how they're to live and function in relationship with him in the Garden of Eden, and they were disobedient. They went against his instructions. And so God begins to declare his judgment, his punishment for their sinful choice of going against him. And he's declaring judgment on Adam and Eve and on the serpent. But right in the middle of the judgment statement is a picture of grace. And a picture of God's plan moving forward. And it's right there in Genesis 3, verse 15. God is speaking to the serpent who had tempted Adam and Eve. And he says this, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He, meaning her offspring, will crush your head, the serpent, and you, the serpent, will strike his heel, meaning the offspring of the woman, that heel. And what Genesis 15 is understood to be is the first messianic prophecy in the Bible, meaning a prophecy about the Messiah, the one who is to come and the one who has come to save. It's a prophecy, as we understand it, about Jesus Christ. Right there in Genesis 3:15. And what God is saying in that verse is, I'm going to figure it out for you. What he's saying about the serpent and Jesus is Jesus will kill the serpent. He'll wipe him out. And the serpent will strike. He'll make a little damaging blow against Christ. But ultimately, Christ will win. It's a picture of grace. And what it should strike in us is a question of, like, okay, well, how's God going to do this? And that's really the rest of the Old Testament in many ways. It continues on, and God says, I'm going to bring about my plan through a family. And so we're introduced to a man named Abram in Genesis 12. And this is God's statement to him of how his plan will move forward. He says, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. What we see here is that God is a God of blessing. And he wants to bless Abram so that Abram can then bless others, so that others would know about this blessing God. But there's one problem in the declaration of Genesis 12 that's then reiterated in Genesis 15, that he will make Abram into a great nation. Abram has no kids. And when he tells his wife about God's declaration of making a great nation through his family, she laughs. She laughs. She doesn't believe it. Why? Because she's old. She's 90 years old. And she's saying, I can't have kids. There's no way. Well, God continues to work out this blessing. And as God is saying this blessing and saying he will provide, right in the middle of it, in Genesis 15, as God is even describing the many family that Abram will have, as many as the stars in the sky, right in there is a prophecy that leads us into the book of Exodus. It says this, right in the middle of God's statement of covenant blessing. Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation. They will serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. And so what we see here is a prophecy about Exodus and a hardship that the nation of Israel, the family of Abraham, are going to go through, even in the midst of God blessing and providing for them. It is immense hardship and adversity that God is saying that they will go through, even as he's saying he will provide and bless them. And this is one of the hard parts that I think of people struggle with reading the Bible. We're drawn to all sorts of nice, kind verses that encourage us and lift us up, and those have a purpose and a role to play in our lives. But there's also parts of the Bible that are hard and difficult to read, and we need to work hard to understand them and then be able to think about them for our own lives. That's part of why I'm wanting, along with Debbie, to teach this class on how to study the Bible so that we can engage with all of God's Word and not just the parts that sound really nice to us, because Genesis 15 has a really hard word right in the middle of blessing and goodness from God. And so what we see here is that God's good plan is unfolding even in the midst of hardship and oppression. And the second part that is worth looking at for us, not only does God have a plan, but God's plan is working. It's working. Verse 7, the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. The same promise that is given to Abraham about the many descendants of his family that will be made into a great nation, that promise is then given to Isaac. and then Jacob, and then Joseph, all throughout the rest of the book of Genesis. And then it comes up here as we open the book of Exodus, because Joseph, through a wild series of events, ends up in Egypt and then ends up in jail and then ends up as the second most powerful person in the country. And he prepares Egypt to deal with a famine that comes on the land, the region all around them. And so people from all over the world are coming to Egypt so they can get food, so they can provide for themselves, including Joseph's family. And so Joseph's family moves to Egypt and they make a family and a nation there, but they're not very big. It says in verse 5 that there's 70 of them, hardly a nation. And just two verses later then, in verse 7, which I just read, it said that the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful, they multiplied greatly, they increased in number, and Egypt was filled with them. And if you have read the creation account of Genesis 1 at all recently, those words used in Exodus 1:7 should ring like bells in your ears, because it's almost a direct quote of Genesis 1:28 and what is known as the creation mandate that God gave Adam and Eve. It says this: God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it." And so what I did on the screen there is I bolded and underlined all of those words that are used in Genesis 1:28 and also used in Exodus 1:7. It's almost a direct quote. And you can read other parts of Genesis 1:20 and Genesis 8 and 9 that use these same words as well. And they're all coming, at least in part, to fulfillment here in Exodus 1. And what it shows us is that the blessing of God is continuing to move forward, and that the blessing of God leads to life, it leads to multiplication, it leads to fruit, and it leads to responsibility. Responsibility, continue to carry it forward. 70 people of Jacob's family entered Egypt, and now between verses 5 and 7, 400 years have passed. 400 years. And so how have they been fruitful? How have they multiplied? Well, Exodus 12:37 tells us exactly how. It says, "The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. There were about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children." And Bible scholars and historians have debated this, and there's varying opinions, but the average that I studied estimated that there were, now 400 years later, after Jacob's family had entered into Egypt, there were now 3 million Israelites comprising the nation of Israel. 70 people to 3 million people over the course of 400 years. What we see here is that the promises of God given to Abram and his family in the book of Genesis are coming to fruition. God is providing. And yet nobody would have ever thought that this would happen in a place of slavery and oppression. It's never how you would draw it up, that God's blessing and provision is coming through. His plan is working, and yet his plan is coming through slavery and hardship and oppression to a people that are marginalized and abused. That part doesn't make sense to our minds. But what we see here very clearly is that the plan of God is moving forward. And here's what I want to talk about, and I think we have to be really honest about it. And you remember just earlier, all those hands that were raised that struggle and doubt and have had times where it seems like God could not be involved or he could not be good. Both cannot be happening at the same time. We have times in our lives where we find ourselves waiting for the promise of God, but God's plan is taking us through immense hardship and difficulty. And the reality is that God's plan is moving forward, but often we cannot see it. And that's what's been happening for 400 years in Exodus. God's plan is moving forward, but the people could not see it. His plan was moving forward. And so we go through times in life where it seems like there's no way that God could be involved. And what Exodus teaches us is that his plan is moving forward even when you cannot see it. And this leads really to more of an application point, or the point that I'd like us to consider as, like, how do we understand what this means for us? God's plan takes time. And that is good news and bad news. It means his plan is going forward, and at times it takes longer than we want. We see this here in Exodus, 400 years between Jacob's family entering the land and when they're released from the oppression of slavery. 400 years. We see this with Abraham. 25 years passed between God saying, I will make you into a great nation, and Abraham having a descendant that begins to make up this family. A son is born. Joseph waited 13 years between when his brothers abandoned him and when he rose to power and prominence in Egypt. Moses spent 40 years as a shepherd wandering in the Midian desert and land. There's a prophet named Anna in the book of Luke. It describes her in the New Testament, who spent all of her widowed years, 50 or 60 years, every day she went to the temple in waiting and in hope and anticipation for the Messiah who was to be born. And right before the end of her life, she met Christ. What we see here is that God's plan takes time. It takes time. And the deliverance that we long for is rarely something that happens in an instant or right away. God uses those years of waiting to shape us and to mold us into the kind of people that he longs for us to be, even as he continues to carry his plan forward. Another way to describe this would be to say that we live in the already but not yet time period of the Christian faith. And what I mean by that is we live in the already. We, by faith, can and have received salvation from God. And all of the blessings that God gives his son, now he bestows to us. And in Ephesians 2, it even says that we are seated in the heavenly realms, in the present, right now. That's where we are by faith. That's the already of our faith. But we also live in the not yet of our faith. The not yet is that Christ has not returned, and we live in a sinful world, and many of the promises that God has given to us have not come to the fullness in our experience. We haven't tasted those yet. In Romans 8, which Casey read from earlier and described kind of the struggle that we have to embrace in this life to be a part of Christ, continues on a few verses after what he read, and it describes more of this struggle in already but not yet kind of terms. In verses 22 and 23, it says, "We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies." The already is that we have the first fruits of the Spirit. The not yet is that we are groaning and longing for our adoption, full, complete, to sonship, the full presence of God with us at all times. Another way to think about this already but not yet that comes to mind for me is the time period of engagement. After a man is proposed to a woman, there's this period of engagement before a wedding. And from my own life, it was the longest 7 months ever. Because what happens after you get engaged? You want to get married. And you want to get married right away. And there is this aspect of the engagement period is already too becoming one in many ways. But there's also this aspect that the two are not one yet, and God has not fully brought the two together yet. And so the period of engagement is this period of waiting and preparation for a marriage that is to come. It is both already, it's coming, and not yet, not quite yet. It should create in a husband and a wife before they're married this kind of what I would describe as a holy dissatisfaction, that they long for something more than the present reality of their life. And that is the Christian faith. We should live in the present with this kind of holy dissatisfaction, that what the reality of our life is right now is not what we ultimately long for. And what we long for is still to come. The already, we can embrace what we have and long for more. What we're longing for is the fullness of home. Because right now we live in a temporary place, a temporary dwelling with temporary bodies that we long for God to make new and to transform and to renew in his time. And so we live in that. And the hardships of our life tell us over and over that the realities that we face right now are not the final destination. We long for something more, something better. And waiting is meant to produce in us this kind of God submitting and yet not accepting the reality that we face as not this, as the status quo. We long for something more, something better. And waiting should produce an angst in us that longs for it all the more because we long to be at home and be made completely new by the power of the Spirit. We long for that and for Jesus to return. And so as I thought about this passage, I thought, well, there's one way that we could end this, and it would be a way to just encourage you that, you know, the hardships you face, they're hard, and have faith and rely on God. But as I was thinking about ending this and talking about the plan of God and this plan taking time and waiting on the Lord and being in the already but not yet, I thought about what's the reality of waiting in our lives. And just this thought came to mind. Waiting produces wandering. Quite often in our lives, if we're really being honest, when we have to wait on God for something that we're longing for, but he has not fully given, it often causes us to doubt, to lose our faith, to look to other things as a source of hope and encouragement in life other than God. Waiting often produces wandering. But here's the good news for those of us who are wanderers. God comes after the wanderer, and he is waiting in anticipation for the wanderer to return home. This is the story that Jesus tells in parable form in Luke 15. God the Father is the prodigal father to the son who left his home with his inheritance and squandered all of his money and only decided when he was eating out of a pigsty that he would come back home and hope his dad would hire him back as a servant. And as he returns home, the father runs after his son and chases after him so that he can show him the love and affection that he has for him because the son who was lost has now been found. It's a story that inspired one of the greatest artists, painters in history named Rembrandt. During his early years, Rembrandt had incredible success, got all sorts of money, all sorts of accolades. He and his wife joined like the elite class of society. They were invited to all the parties. They were able to do all the things. And he thought so highly of himself that he painted the prodigal son in his kind of escapades in the height of his spending all of his money and all of that. He painted his own face as the prodigal son and celebrating and drinking with his wife, who he painted into the picture as well. It was like this picture of how he saw himself and his immense success. Well, life went on for Rembrandt. His wife died. He battled depression and all of his money dried up. And just a few years before the end of his life, he painted one of his most famous paintings called The Return of the Prodigal Son. And you can see it up on the screen there. In the painting, you can kind of see the older brother to the right, kind of in the shadow. But right at the forefront of the picture is the father embracing the son. And there's a few really important aspects of the painting to notice. One is that the father's eyes are closed. He's just embracing the moment. And then that you can hardly see the son's face. It's kind of veiled or clouded by the clothes of the father that are kind of enveloping the son. And then the other part to notice is his hands. His hands aren't just resting on the son. If you could tell the detail of the painting, his hands are gripping the Son. It's not a half-hearted embrace. It's the Father pulling the Son close to him so that he knows the Son, feels the affection that he has for him. And I wonder if it was Rembrandt's way of how he viewed himself later in life, a failure who had squandered everything that God had brought to him, and he was only now returning home and recognizing his need for the Father after all of his escapades in his younger years. Many of us are like the wandering son. The waiting has produced wandering. And God's heart for you is not a statement of judgment. It's a statement of love and grace. Henry Nouwen wrote a book on this parable, the parable of the prodigal son. And he describes the importance of seeing God as that kind of father. Because what we often do when we make mistakes is we see God as like a landlord. Like the son saw his father when he was returning home. He thought, well, at the very best, maybe my dad will make me a servant. He lost sight of the way that his father saw him. Here's how Henry Nouwen describes this. As long as I keep looking at God as a landowner, as a father who wants to get the most out of me for the least cost, I cannot but become jealous, bitter, and resentful toward my fellow workers or my brothers and sisters. But if I am able to look at the world with the eyes of God's love and discover that God's vision is not that of a stereotypical landowner or patriarch, but rather that of an all-giving and forgiving father who does not measure out his love to his children according to how well they behave, then I quickly see that my only true response can be deep gratitude. Our God is a blessing God, and the blessings that he longs to give far outrun our faith that often fails. That's our kind of God, and his posture toward the wanderer who struggled in the waiting is to invite them in and to grip them and to draw them close with a statement of affection. And I think of our memory verse for this month, Jeremiah 29:13, which I think is a great verse to keep in mind as we think about coming home to the Father. Jeremiah 29:13, you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. That's a statement for the wanderer. It was a statement for Jeremiah as he struggled to keep sight of the Lord in the midst of his depression and struggle. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. And so the opportunity for us as wandering, prodigal people is to take in the Lord's embrace. No matter where we've gone, God invites us back in and brings us his embrace. And how much does God love us? Well, we see it in the communion meal that we're about to be able to partake in. We see it in this meal because God gave his son. He gave his only son to show us how much he loves and cares for us, that Jesus would take our place of death for our sin so that we could experience life and closeness with the God who made us. And so we come to the table as people of faith to partake in this meal, as people in need of God's work and mercy in our lives. There's two tables up front here. There's a table in the back that has gluten-free on it as well. And the worship team's going to lead us in a couple songs as we respond. And really, the opportunity for us is to come home to the Lord as we've wandered, to come back to him.